from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Therese Marie Maillat's debut book is called Heartberries, and it recalls a childhood darkened by abuse, addiction, and abject poverty. Indigenous identity is fixed in grief, she writes, and she grew up on the Seabird Island Indian Reservation in British Columbia. She joins us this segment to discuss her memoir and how her identity as a Native woman influences her work. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. Your book is searing, and it's an extraordinary accomplishment. Congratulations on it. In fact, just to give listeners a little taste of what I'm talking about, Sherman Alexie, who many of the listeners know, who has appeared on the show a number of times, says, I was aware within maybe three sentences that I was in the presence of a generational talent. I was in the presence of something new. To be glib, Therese is putting the original in Aboriginal. This is high praise, and congratulations on those words from much-admired writer Sherman Alexie. You're doing a lot in here that's so personal, and you're opening up a lot of wounds, and I admire the bravery that you have in doing this. But there's a trajectory. With all you go through, there's a way. There's a way toward redemption, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I think in order to pull through, I had to imagine it was to some end. And for me, that was like an intellectual renaissance in a space where I find the time and luxury to create art and how beautiful that is.
And you've been creating art here. In fact, working on Rumpus as an editor, in addition to that, with Stephen Elliott, who's also appeared on this show. But this is a book of self-discovery, and it's also a book of self-loathing.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have to have one to have the other, or is that just you that has to have one to have the other?
I think to interrogate the self, sometimes you have to be critical, and it does feel like a loathing thing, and it was difficult for me to really examine all of my transgressions in relation to the things that have happened to me, and not think it was causal. Think I had to be accountable for the things that I had done, you know, in my life, and I had to own them in order to own myself away from
that. Well, there's certainly a lot of your transgressions, you come clean on those, but there's also a lot of suffering, I mean, suffering poverty and trauma, and so that's from the outside.
Yeah, and I grew up in a small Indian reservation. There were about 600 people, and most of us did not graduate high school, and most of us were living in poverty, and so many of us depended on the system for support. So coming from that circumstance, I wanted to write a book that honors that circumstance and kind of illustrates what that really looks like.
You know? You also honor motherhood in this book, and you honor your Native ancestry in this book. There's a lot of honoring as well as confessional and as well as pouring out your grief and the terrible kind of things that you went through. In fact, you began writing this in a mental institution?
Yeah, I was... They gave me a composition book. I had committed myself for suicidal ideation and obsessive thoughts, and they gave me a composition book, and that's where I started to write the essay Indian Sick in the memoir, and it was epistolary to my now husband, Casey. Yeah.
Speaking about now husbands, I mean, things have kind of calmed down in your life. there's one moment in the book, for example, where you're having to give up your son to a court at the same time that you're going through a pregnancy where you're giving birth to another son.
Yeah, the day I had a bitter divorce when I was very young, and I tried to maintain custody of my 3-year-old child at the time. And I won in provincial court and then Supreme Court in Canada. And then in the Hague Convention, I lost him. And it was the day that he was removed was the same day that I brought home my second son. And that kind of tragedy and coincidence is too perfectly awful, you know?
Writing therapeutic?
In the way that therapy is really hard. Yeah, it can be cathartic when you can't speak something, writing it down is a lot easier.
Well, there's an interview at the end of your book where you talk about rawness and you say, that's not an appropriate word as far as I'm concerned. I mean, a lot of this writing would be taken for raw, but raw would mean covering it up, being sentimental about it, putting it into a different context, giving into your feelings to sort of mask things.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do that.
Yeah, I think it takes to exact this feeling, to exact my mental health issues and what suicidal ideation looks like. If I were to be raw about it, I would just be crying. But really, to exact it and articulate it, it takes a lot of intellectual work. It takes a lot of mind work to try to illustrate it in a way that is not as sentimental, you know?
Well, this is an odyssey, really, to get you to accept yourself in many ways. I mean, that's how I read it.
Yeah. And I think the thing about writing the book is I really didn't know what trajectory it was going to take. I didn't know that I would arrive at a place where I honored my mother and forgave her. And somehow writing it allowed me to forgive her, you know, but I never let go of her. I am still very much connected to her. You know, I could feel her in the room most of the time.
Again, a line from Sherman Alexie: she is a biological child of a broken healer and a lonely artist. That kind of sums up your parents, although he also says you're the metaphorical love child of Emily Dickinson and Crazy Horse.
Yeah.
Kind of love.
Yeah, I love that.
Let's talk a little bit about, Crazy Horse. I mean, your Native identity is central to this. And, I mean, you see yourself through different eyes because you are a Native.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and yet all of that influence comes in from the Caucasian world, from the white world, from the world outside the reservation. And it's a hybridization, isn't it? It's a mixing and a confusion sometimes.
Yeah, I think sometimes when people read my book and review it and they have no familiarity with Indigenous writers, they assume that I'm trying to give humanity to Native Americans. And I think that's so absurd because we're human, so obviously. And they think I'm trying to give credence to you. Our culture and practices and establish myself and that this is representative of all Native Americans or a triumph for all Native Americans. But
there's so many tribes to begin with.
We are, our work is singular and our sovereign nations are so different from one another. And I wish people would try to examine the work on its merits, you know, its own merit, and not try to relate it to, like, that this is a quintessential Native text. This is so much more, just the way Sherman Alexie's work is so much more than just the work of a Native. It's not a Black Elk Speaks, you know? We are not writing that, yeah.
Well said. In fact, it actually bothers me that there's this lumping together of Native writers. They're so... read a lot of Native literature, and there's so much difference depending on tribe and region and background, obviously, family and so forth. But you also are well aware of the kind of stereotypes. I mean, Sherman, for example, writes about alcoholism. You write about alcoholism. And these are – Michael Doris wrote a great deal about fetal alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And these are things that are attached to Native identity from the outside.
Yeah. How could I not write about alcoholism? My father was a very violent drunk, you know? And I don't feel burdened by the stigma or stereotype. Sometimes I do when I go to a bar and there is the knowledge that I'm Native. If it's in an area where there is a Native community and they can tell by looking at me and I order a drink, I'm aware of the stigmas against me. And sometimes it takes longer for me to get that drink, you know? And, but when I'm working on the page, I don't try to burden myself with what this means for Native people, that there is another text or another discussion about Natives and alcoholism, because I think in any rural community or any community that's impoverished, there's going to be substance abuse. We're going to cope the way that we have to, or we're going to turn to things and have mental health issues, suicidality, like all of those things are going to trouble us. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Emily Dickinson side of you. I mean, your work is quite poetic, and you were struggling living on a reservation where, as you said, most people didn't even graduate from high school. Where did you discover language?
Emily Dickinson.
It was literally Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, and John Steinbeck and Raymond Carver. And my mother was, she read all the time, just literally. She always had a book in every room of the house. And So I would often sneak her books, even though I was way too young, to read something like Emily Dickinson. And, you know, in grade school, I was reciting, "I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are You Nobody Too?" And, you know, I love her work, and I was always fascinated with death, even at a young age. So she's really striking to me. Yeah.
What do you think was really compelling you to all that suicide ideation? Was it a kind of self-loathing mainly, or was it just a feeling that you wanted to simply destroy yourself, or both?
I think women where I'm from, they are forgotten a lot, you know, and when there are crimes against us, people think we deserve it, you know, and even as a child, it was hard to relate to my mother, that the way that she verbally abused me or neglected me made me feel bad. And the way that my father mistreated me made me feel bad. And having nobody to listen makes you feel like nothing, you know, and that self-worth, the lack of self-worth made me want to stop living. And I feel like being poor also can make you feel forgotten, you know, or being narrowed down as a label on at-risk youth on casework. It can make you feel like, what do I have to live for if I'm never going to break free of these things, you know?
We're discussing a great number of things with our guest, and our guest is the author of Heartberries. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. Therese Marie Myatt is here with us in studio and may want to comment on some of the things we're talking about, not only finding language to really break the barriers of feelings of self-degradation, but also self-worth and how to find it, and really questions about poverty, about Native identity. We do welcome your involvement. If you have something you'd like to ask or say, please feel free to join the program. Let me give you the toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We do want to hear from you, so please feel free to join us with questions or comments. Again, the toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Have other Native American writers who have influenced you, particularly women writers? I'm thinking about Leslie Marmon Silko and Louise Erdrich. And, yeah.
Yeah. No, I love Silko. Ceremony is, for me, I mean, I've read it probably 9 times in the last 3 years, you know, because it's so...
That's 3 a year. That's a lot.
It's so good. Yeah. Because it's got everything a traditional, like, novel experience should. You know, it has harrowing tragedy, it does have triumph, and it has, you know, it even has a little magic and mysticism that, like, I would resist in my own work, but I feel like within our culture, we really can't resist it sometimes. And I like what she's doing, you know?
Do you like that? You know, some would say that romanticizing almost is another type of stereotype, you know, being one with nature and going back to the ancestors being, and you write about these things. But to you, they're palpable. They're real, are they not?
Yeah, it feels tangible. I mean, I feel like I'm on a continuum of, you know, Native women who were healers and planters and knew how to cultivate land and knew how to empower other people in their communities. And that feels just physical. It feels real. Like I have access to goodness in me that comes directly from them, you know?
And time is perceived often, particularly from the Native perspective, as much more circular.
Yeah.
As opposed to linear, we Westerners.
Yeah. And we're always, yeah.
Cursed with, yeah.
Yeah. We're always taught that we come into this world dependent and we leave this world dependent on our families and our communities. So that's why we are so grounded in community, you know? Everything is cyclical. We love circles in my culture, yeah.
And there's a lot of folk culture with tied to circles and tied to circular identity and the whole sense of collectiveness. In fact, one of the things I notice about Native American writing is, Native writing, indigenous writing, is that it often has a collective voice that's very connected to the tribe or to peoplehood and so forth, as well as nature. At one point you say, "I'm a river widened by misery." I mean, that's, again, that almost complete identification with what's out there in the natural world.
Yeah, I mean, and that metaphor works on so many levels that, like, you know, I am a river widened by misery, and the more that I've been able to endure and exist within, the stronger my current, and the more the salmon run can come and replenish my community, you know, like I am.
You're right there with Sherman Alexie with that salmon run.
Oh, we love salmon. So, I mean, that's one reason why we get along or did get along so well. Yeah.
But I remember the salmon jumping and the salmon being like, and that story is about Phoenix, Arizona, where, you know, reborn, the father is reborn in the salmon jumping and so forth. All right, let me get to our callers here. Before I do, a listener wants to know, how did you come to terms with revealing so much about yourself? Was it a struggle to be that vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, because I have an anxiety disorder. I have post-traumatic stress disorder, so I'm just always anxious. And then when you couple that with revealing the worst parts of yourself in motherhood and marriage and childhood, it's anxious-making. My face turns red sometimes when I read my work, but when I see the reaction, men come up to me even and they say, I wish I could be that vulnerable. I wish I could talk about that because I think I would feel a lot better if I did.
But you do feel shame, don't you?
Yeah.
When you put all that out there.
But then it's so much better than living in the dark. It's so much better.
Well, at one point later on in the book, and I'm not giving away any secrets of the book, I hope, here, but you say, I am. I've never felt that I could say those words. I mean, that's what would use a fancy word or what I would call ontological. You're getting at the source of your being, of who and what you are.
Mm-hmm. And I've never existed in the present either because I've existed in poverty, which makes you think in the future and behind all the time, and you feel like you're running. You know, I never had the luxury of being present, and now I do, and it is amazing and scary.
Let me bring some callers aboard here. First caller is joining us from Tucson. Stephanie, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you.
So, thanks. So my question is, as someone who has had a loved one to have committed suicide in the past, but did have writing as an outlet and was actually a very beautiful writer, was there anything else that you did besides just your writing that helped you sort of transition into this healthier place in your life?
Yeah, I mean, one of the major steps was committing myself, and I had to commit myself, but I also had to consult within my own culture how we would have treated depression or that kind of illness. And I am constantly every day doing all the coping exercises I was taught in group therapy about handling your anxiety and not, you know, when you're irritable, check in. And if you need support, reach out. And I also have a good support system, you know, because, you know, I grew up around my own youth worker, Annette. She committed suicide, and she was a wonderful writer, you know, and I'm so sorry that your friend passed away. That's terrible. To be honest, I use every tool to stay alive, you know.
Including your ancestors who are watching over you now.
Yeah.
You know, we were mentioning Emily Dickinson, but you mentioned in an interview I read Adrienne Rich, and I can't help thinking about the importance of a poem like Diving into the Wreck.
In terms of which,
that's what you're doing here, aren't you?
The book feels like diving into the wreck, you know, and it is this retrieval of something and this this willful dive into something that is deeply personal and intimate. I feel like Rich is really good at that, really good at imparting the beauty of those dark memories and dark things, you know?
The book, again, is Heartberries. Therese Marie Myot is here with us, and let's get to another caller, and that's you. Tune, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if your book touches upon acculturation and cultural identity, or if you have something to say about it. If you will allow me to describe myself, I also suffer from PTSD and anxiety. And we came to this country as refugees. I spent 10 years of my, the beginning of my life in Burma, where we spoke nothing but Burmese because of the fear of being selected for scapegoating. And having been raised in San Francisco, we learned English. But all my life, I never felt that I could fully express my true feelings and thoughts in either language. And I wonder if you can say a little something about linguistics. And I know philosophy has no true language, but I feel perhaps your book touches upon philosophy.
Yeah, I think it does. My grandmother and my mother and my uncles, they were all put in residential school, which was Indian residential school. They took the children from our communities and to assimilate them into the white majority culture, they raised them, and then when they turned 18, would release them back into the world or into a city or back into their communities. And in those schools, they stripped our people of the language, and you weren't allowed to speak it or you would be beat. So it's a very interesting thing to consider that, you know, that, and our ceremonies,
it's a kind of cultural
too.
Genocide, yeah. Really. I mean, you're taking away yeah. people's language, you're taking away their identity, and you're taking away their whole cultural history.
Yeah, and there is that feeling, the absence of these practices that are lost now. That feeling doesn't go away, and it really does hurt to see a cultural genocide and to exist. It's almost post-apocalyptic, you know?
I'm reading a comment from a listener named Noel apropos of that, who says, reading Sherman Alexie's memoirs, I was struck by the intergenerational trauma, not just in his family, but due to the American government's policy of boarding schools and other ways we have tried to subjugate the tribes.
Yeah. I mean, intergenerational trauma is very real. I mean, carrying the memories of almost, you know, 500 years of grief, you know, of survival. And that it is, I mean, my mother ran away from Indian school, and I feel like her being able to do that has given me so much. Her resistance to assimilate into the culture, and she turned to a life of social work after, you know?
Your mother was a healer in many traditional ways, wasn't she?
Yeah, she always used to take me up to the mountain and to the river, and we used to pick medicine and dry it and make it. And, you know, we were just, she was such a wonderful teacher, even with all of her mixed upness, you know? Yeah.
I think you're a teacher, too. I mean, certainly your book has
yeah.
much to offer.
Oh, quite literally, too. I teach creative writing now.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. in fact, you started writing fiction. What made you switch to nonfiction?
I guess I felt compelled to reveal, because I thought it would help other people if I was able to cultivate beauty out of my life and have it be in a library for people who experienced trauma and wanted to see how I push through it, you know?
It is inspiring, and it's also kind of a new form for the memoir. I mean, you've written a memoir, but
yeah.
it's definitely a different style of memoir or a different type of memoir. And I should mention that you're teaching now, you're what, a postdoc fellow at Purdue?
Yeah, and I'm also teaching creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Yeah.
And still writing?
Oh, yeah, every day.
Nonfiction?
Yeah.
Or are you moving back
a
to fiction?
A little bit of both. I just published a short story in West Branch. Roxane Gay solicited me for it, and she's awesome. And yeah, it's a horror story. It was quite fun to write. Yeah.
Or like the old traditional horror stories?
Yeah, it's very, it's like, you know, it's like a Native woman's, it's like a Native woman's Edgar Allan Poe, I think, you know, it's got all the kind of, it's got some impish cruelty in it that I like. Yeah.
So when people say to you, as, you know, as a Native woman, what do you think of this? Or as a Native woman, what do you think of that? Do you speak, sometimes feel as if you're speaking for your tribe, for your people, for yourself, or all of the above?
The way I was raised, how I interact in public is going to reflect on my people for sure. But then, on the other hand, I am definitely more outspoken than many, and I was a little bit of a wild one, so I'm aware that I'm breaking some rules as I'm going along here.
Let me read a tweet from a listener named Mike who says, "So, things are just as bad for natives in Canada as they are here in the U.S.? We always think that Canada is more progressive."
Oh, no, and Justin Trudeau, he is constant, because of the pipelines and because of his inability to discuss the topics of intergenerational trauma or cultural genocide, he is just as a problem as someone like Trump. He is exploiting Indigenous land, and he's throwing out Native women from press conferences and explicitly telling, get her out of here. Like, he's doing that. And
because they're protesting.
Yeah, they're protesting. Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, most Americans would not believe the analogy of Trudeau to Trump. I mean,
yeah.
Because they seem politically so far apart.
I mean, the left can be just as lecherous. I mean, especially that covert racism. It's, it's debatable, though. I would debate it. I'd be open to listening. But there is a lot of exploitation. There is a lot of he's completely silenced so many. And plus, there was recently, I mean, if we look at the trial of Cindy Gladue, or there's been so much, there's been injustice there. Yeah.
Again, the book is Heartberries, and our guest, Therese Marie Mayotte. And I got seconds left here. What are your plans?
Gosh, I am reading at Kepler's. Right now I'm about to go to Stanford for the first time. That's going to be amazing.
You'll be at Kepler's tonight at 7:30.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you are a Tecumseh postdoctoral fellow at Purdue.
Yeah.
You've been covered with a lot of literary glory, also an editor at the Rumpus.
Yeah.
So glad to have had you on. Thank you so much for joining us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. When we come back, we're going to talk about timing. Daniel Pink, the best-selling author, has a book out about scientific secrets of perfect timing. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.